Hello, and welcome to Physics Frontiers, Episode 48, The Gerstenstein Effect. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/48. Show notes include links to the papers that we talk about in this podcast, as well as related episodes and things like that. And now, Jim and Randy.
How you doing, Jim?
I'm doing all right, Randy. What's going on?
Well, this week we're going to talk about a little-known but absolutely fascinating effect called the Gerstenstein effect. A Russian physicist back in the 60s, I believe, discovered that a photon propagating through a transverse magnetic field will convert into gravitational radiation, which is kind of shocking. And you can actually do this back the other way. You can convert photons into gravity and gravity into photons, gravitational waves. And so I thought we should talk about this. And you found an especially fascinating paper, the third one we're going to talk about today. So the first one we're going to talk about today is Wave Resonance of Light and Gravitational Waves by Mikhail Gerstenstein. And that was in the Soviet Physics Journal of Experimental and Theoretical Physics in 1961. And the final paper that you found is absolutely thrilling. I mean, as a theoretical physicist, you just gotta love this kind of work. It's called Some Consequences of Gravitationally Induced Electromagnetic Effects in Microphysics by Rosquist. And this was in a 10th Italian-Korean Symposium on Relativistic Astrophysics in 2007. Really brilliant work. I love this kind of stuff, and you're gonna understand why when we get to it.
That's good. And the third one is more or less doing the same thing as Wave Resonance of Light and Gravitational Waves, except it's looking at what happens in alternative theories of gravity.
I think you're referring to the graviton-photon oscillation in alternative theories of gravity paper, right?
Yeah, that one, you know, the first section, well, I guess the second section after the introduction, basically redoes Gerstenstein's stuff, you know, just talking about graviton-photon mixing itself. So it's more or less the same thing. And then it starts talking about some stuff that they've been doing with alternative theories of gravity.
Yeah, there's some interesting terms that come up in there. But first, let's go over just the basic effect. I mean, that's kind of the shocking simplicity of it, is that Gerstenstein figured out that you can convert electromagnetic radiation into gravitational radiation and back, which is, you know, a wonderful finding. Of course, we're talking about really low energy gravitational radiation. I mean, it would take, I saw an article online, let me see, where was that, at New Scientist, where some American company had proposed using gravitational radiation for propulsion purposes. This company called GravWave, and like the Defense Intelligence Agency or somebody was tasked with analyzing to see how, if this was viable. And they found that in order to overcome the acceleration of gravity at the surface of the Earth, that you'd have to spend 10 to the 25 times the energy output of the entire world in order to levitate a craft using the Gerstenstein effect to propel itself. So we're talking about very small effects, but nevertheless, I mean, especially theoretically, this kind of stuff is absolutely fascinating. I think that it also works with an electrical field. I remember seeing that mentioned somewhere. And I'm guessing that since the fields have to be transverse to the propagation of the photon, that somehow you're looking at like a quadrupole moment within that, that allows it to mix with, to create gravitational radiation, right? Or rather amplify it, right?
Well, technically, something like that would have to happen, but I think it's a little bit different. So you have an interesting thing where this has to be in a large magnetic field that, you know, they're calling transverse, and I assume that's transverse to the propagation. And all the analysis is done in a region of sort of a small curvature, but non-negligible curvature, right? So I think it has to do with that curvature of space-time, because there is no dipole moment, because you're just looking at two linear waves that happen to resonate. Right. They both have to be propagating in the same direction, and they both have to have the same frequency, basically.
I think he's suggesting that there's a lot of this gravitational radiation out there in the low frequency and in the very high frequency ranges because of stellar activity, right?
Yeah. So I think he's saying that on top of the really low frequency, I think, activity, you're also going to see peaks in higher frequencies that correspond to the general radiation of stars. So the electromagnetic radiation of stars, whenever that electromagnetic radiation gets to a reasonably curved section of space-time, there's going to be some transfer between the two systems, between the gravitational and the electromagnetic system.
So there's a coupling because of wave resonance.
That's the whole point. You've got the curved space-time, you've got a resonance between the oscillations in the electromagnetic spectrum and the oscillations in the gravitational spectrum.
I was intrigued to also to note that, doing a little poking around online, that although these effects are really tiny in free space, not only could they be amplified if when we look at alternative theories of gravity in the next paper, but there's also prospects for amplifying effects like this in materials. There was a paper I saw online, Enhanced Gerstenstein Effect in Type 2 Superconductors, where and that was a 2006 paper. So that's intriguing. You know, it's yet another area like we had looked at with the photonic metamaterials papers, where materials may one day give us the opportunity to amplify effects that are very tenuous, you know, and maybe one day make some actual use of this kind of stuff. But the last paper offered an interesting scenario at the microscopic, at the subatomic area, where some of these effects might actually be observable in like the electric quadrupole moment and so forth. So let's take a closer look at this next paper, because Gerstenstein didn't really, besides laying out the mathematical argument and giving us an example of amplitude, the Gerstenstein paper was actually very brief. Didn't really probe too deeply. There was another paper mentioned in that last paper where some physicists had gone a lot deeper. Here it is. They say that there was a Johnston, Ruffini, and Zarelli paper, or a couple of them actually, that explored the Gerstenstein effect more rigorously.
Those were talking about sort of balancing gravitational electromagnetic radiation in black holes. This guy does have a lot of really good references in there that look really interesting. These two, he was referencing something to do with balancing these in black holes, which is sort of close to what he's talking about. He's talking a lot about black holes in that paper.
Yeah, and specific types of black holes become critical in his examination of like Einstein and Maxwell field equations. Okay, so in the second paper that we're going to look at, the graviton-photon oscillation paper, they're talking about different types of alternative theories of gravity, and they bring up some terminology which is new to me. They're talking about how an alternative theory of gravity implies gravitational waves propagating as if they're moving through a diagravitational medium.
Yeah, that's something that's actually theirs, I think. So when I was looking at this earlier today, they have another 2018 paper where they've set up this analogy, the modified gravity as a diagravitational medium. This is actually their own way of modeling alternative theories of gravity. What that seems to mean mostly is that the speed of gravity is slightly different than the speed of light. And that's going to be true for certain classes of modified gravity. I think we probably talked a little bit about that when we talked about either the FR formulations or the PPN formulations. At least in one of those papers, they were talking about it, but those were both giant papers.
They talk about how this would have a diagravitational refractive index. That's really intriguing.
Yeah, so if you had a modified gravity and you had a region where the speed of gravity reduced, right, just like in a dielectric material, the speed of light reduces, then you're going to get, you know, gravitational refraction.
Is it possible that a material could have a diagravitational refractive index, or is this just properties of space-time in near, like, really, like, astronomical bodies and that kind of thing?
This has just got to do with space-time itself. This has to do with modified gravities as models of the space-time medium, which they have to be. You look at how they actually act, and some of them have a difference in the propagation speed of light, and then you can model it as if you were dealing with a dielectric material, or in this case, a diagravitational space-time.
Do you think we would have detected any diagravitational properties of space-time with the LIGO detections of like black hole collisions, that kind of thing?
I expect that these guys don't think so, because at least in one of these papers, and I think this was one of them, they were going through, I think, like half of, maybe not half of these references, but But a big chunk of these references, there were about 40, and these are about 8. So about 20% of the references are saying whole classes of modified gravities are no longer viable because of experiments like the LIGO one. Apparently, LIGO, even if it can detect some things, is not good enough to detect these at this time. You know, the first person to try to model gravity as a medium was, this is hard. He's a famous guy. And it was ancient stuff. Oh, crap. Now I'm not going to be able to talk until I figure out what his name
is. Shit, sorry.
I mean, he's, you know, super famous. So, Laplace, actually. Yeah, it was Laplace. So Laplace decided to model gravity as a fluid because he didn't really believe this whole crazy gravity acts immediately thing. But then he figured out that if he had a fluid between the sun and the earth that mediated gravity, it would be so dense there wouldn't be an earth for the gravity to attract anymore, because it would have lost all of its orbital energy and fallen into the sun.
Yeah, I remember seeing some estimate that it was like dozens of orders of magnitude denser than steel.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what it was with that, but I do know that the speed of gravity in that case would have still had to have been really, really high, right? So for the Earth not to fall into the sun. So people have been looking at something like that for quite a long time. For these theories to be viable, they have to give a speed of gravity that's at least comparable to the speed of light, right? So probably with LIGO or something like that, or you're just looking at things from so long ago. But possibly when they get more detectors online, they'll have a better idea about, you know, these delays, and they'll be able to rule out more of these things. I think probably anything with a effective speed of light that's different from C, I think probably they're almost all out already.
Yeah, because I think in at least one case, they were able to detect gamma rays that are associated with the collision, and they found that they were really, really close in timing.
I think listening to some guy talk about this, as I recall, that was, you know, just complete luck that they were able to get both of those at the same time. But they were able to see it. So you're saying the speed of light and the speed of gravity have to be basically the same. So there's not a lot of room in such a modified theory of gravity for the speed of light to change. We saw that already in the PPN formalism. You know, almost everything that's a deviation like that fails at some level somewhere.
But they did have some interesting findings that even setting aside the problem, they said that in section 4 that it's possible to have a complete conversion of gravitational waves into electromagnetic waves, which is kind of fascinating.
Did they actually have a number for what that field would have to be?
I don't know. I didn't take that down as a note if they did. I think they were just speaking in more general theoretical terms.
Yeah, I mean, that has a resonance for the mixing. Everything should mix at a certain sort of angle.
Yeah, that's what they're talking about, like mixing angles and that kind of stuff. So theoretically, it is possible, but it might require a very specific situation. But still, it's kind of amazing to think of them being completely converted into one another like that.
Yeah, I'm still a little bit weirded out by this transverse magnetic field, because I don't know how large it has to be and how common that would be. I didn't really see anything that told me how large it would have to be. It's just that it shows up in all of the papers. And so, you know, if it's a sort of small one, right, if it's a micro Gauss field, then it's not much of a big deal. It probably happens all the time, right? But if it's, you know, a 7 Tesla field or something, then probably it's only in very specific and very lucky situations that you're going to get this wave mixing.
Well, I mean, it's going to be a matter of magnitude, right? I mean, that's really even at a modest, like, you know, 1 Tesla field, you know, in terms of cosmic scales, that's pretty modest. I mean, there's probably magnetars with some ridiculously high magnetic field, right?
I don't know what cosmic magnetic fields are like.
But is there any theoretical upper limit to the strength of a magnetic field?
I wouldn't expect so.
All right, so a magnetar can have like a 10 to the 10th Tesla field.
Well, that sounds pretty big.
Yeah, I think we might, you know, if we had one nearby, we might be able to actually observe some of this Gertzenstein effect stuff going on.
Well, probably not. Probably all of our equipment would fly off the Earth to it only takes a couple of Tesla to have screwdrivers flying across the room, so that's really big.
Well, this paper about alternative theories of gravity really makes me wonder, like, if there's some way to... I mean, I've always thought of the gravitational waves and gravity as just a field that permeates all matter. You can't shield gravity, you know. But this idea that maybe a material, if not a space-time like these alternative theories of gravity are saying, but maybe there's some way to engineer a material, some kind of gravitational metamaterial, so that you could refract and focus or, you know, interact with the gravitational field or at least gravitational waves.
Well, I guess there could be if the wavelengths are, you know, reasonably small. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, they always want to get larger and larger gravitational wave detectors because the wavelengths are really large for those gravitational waves.
What's that one they want to build in space?
I forgot the name of it. I was just looking at it a couple days ago.
LISA, the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna. That's it. I'm really dying to see that stuff go online.
They've been talking about it for a while. Like I said in a previous podcast, you know, they were talking about it when I was an undergraduate.
Okay, so was there anything else in that paper about alternative theories of gravity that we should go over?
No, I mean, it's the title, I think it sounded really, really interesting, but I don't think it had as much in it as I thought. In fact, it looks like a really good thing to try to do in some other formalism, to be honest, right? If you're going to look at a bunch of theories of gravity at one point, at one time, this particular way of looking at them, this analogy with the diagravitational medium, probably isn't the one that gets the most likely alternative theories. I think that PPN formalism did, right, get most of those. Although it would be fun to look at this with, but it might not work with the PPN because the PPN is supposed to be sort of small energy stuff. But all of these are in the small energy perturbations, so it might actually work. Also be fun to look at this with your bimetric theory, but maybe not your bimetric theory. Maybe.
Yes, Sabine Hossetfelder's.
Unless you got one in the last 2 months. Did you make one?
No, I haven't come up with one yet.
Okay. So it would be interesting to try to look at something like that in that case as well, see how that secondary field affected that.
There was a point in here that was intriguing where they talked about a graviton-photon mixing in the early universe when densities were really high and fields could have been much stronger. And there could have been primordial black holes interacting with, you know, all of that. Come to think of it, a black hole might have a really strong magnetic field. So they think that might have an effect on the cosmic X-ray background.
Aren't they doing that?
I'm sure somebody's looking at it, but I guess I'm assuming that there's not a sufficient resolution to see this kind of thing, because I think even under those conditions, it'd probably be a really minor effect. So do you want to look at some consequences of gravitationally induced electromagnetic effects in microphysics?
Oh, that would be lovely.
This paper is just fantastic. It only seems to touch on the Gerzenstein effect a little bit, but it does such a great, fundamental, rigorous look at gravitational, gravitomagnetic effects at subatomic scales that this is like a dream paper. I've always wanted to see an analysis like this, and I always thought I'd have to do it myself if I wanted to know this stuff.
What did you find so interesting about it?
One of the things that he does is he looks at the charge to mass ratio at various scales and the spin, and there was a great confirmation in there where he said that spin is not an entirely quantum mechanical effect, that there's actually a real spin happening with an electron and nuclear magnetic moments and all that kind of stuff. And he said that the electron, for example, it's spinning so fast that the gravitomagnetic effects are at the same scale as the gravitoelectric effect. Like its rest mass and its dipole, gravitational dipole moment are on the same scale. And that just kind of blew my mind. I always thought there'd be something fascinating going on with general relativistic effects at the subatomic scale, but I'd never seen it quantified and explained so clearly.
Well, I mean, that's really just a special relativist thing. But, I mean, still, you know, that spin is interesting. So if you're looking at just the charge to mass ratio, if you're looking at the gravitoelectric field, the normal gravitational effects versus the electric field, that gets less and less important as the size of your object reduces, right? It's just almost nothing, right? There's like a factor of 10 to the 21st difference. But then the spin, if you look at the spin and look at the gravitomagnetic effect from the spin of the object, or, I mean, you don't have to think of it as a spin. It's just an angular momentum, and that's sufficient, right? And apparently, you know, this angular momentum doesn't decompose completely. So it's really the full angular momentum of the electron. But you see that when you get down to, you know, something like the Compton scale, at least, that gravitomagnetic field that has to do with your mass flow is very, very large, right? Just because of the electron spin. That's really interesting the way he looked at that.
Yeah, and I also like the fact that he looked at the mass scale at which gravitational effects and electromagnetic effects sort of become equivalent. And this is like one order of magnitude lower than the Planck mass.
Yeah, that was a weird thing that it happened to be this Stoney mass, and Stoney was some guy who just decided to use the electric charge as a unit of mass, and that turned out to be 2 micrograms, which is 1/10 of a Planck mass.
And so suddenly there's a way to look at subatomic particles with both the gravitational and the electromagnetic effects, you know, interacting with each other and also in similar ways. And then he discovers new things that I hadn't heard of ever before. Apparently there's like an infinite series of gravitomagnetic multipoles going on at the subatomic scale.
What he's saying is that, yeah, there's going to have to be a series of these things. So he says, well, you know, we're going to break these up into the different components. And if you start breaking up into components, there are more parts of it. So, like, if you take the electric field, right, of a charge distribution, there's going to be your basic electric field, then there'll be your monopole electric field, your dipole electric field, your quadrupole electric field, your octupole electric field, and they're all just components, right? Because they're sort of orthogonal to each other. So you just add the one to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. But the really weird thing about that is only the highest order belongs to the object itself. So that would be considered like the spin. And then all of the higher order ones belong to the object as it relates to the observer, right? So those are all like the orbital contribution. And that's what he's talking about, is that you end up with this dipole in this curved space-time doing something funky, because basically what you're doing is you're modeling it. He was modeling it with a couple of different things, but in the end, I think he wants to use a Kerr-Newman method, or Kerr-Newman. It's Kerr-Newman. It's Kerr-Newman, yeah. A Kerr-Newman metric to model the field, and that will basically be a dipole plus a quadrupole plus a octupole plus a so on and a so forth. My Latin's not good enough to continue that series.
Yeah, it's okay. Mine either.
I mean, that's all he's saying. That's something you actually get into in a junior level electrodynamics class.
Well, then he talks about how general relativity predicts the gravitational field of a spinning charge induces changes in its electromagnetic field, which make it deviate from a pure Coulomb form at small distances. That's kind of awesome. I mean, he's saying that there's a potentially detectable shift in the Coulomb field because of general relativistic effects.
I think he was saying that there were some experiments that said there was a bit of a difference. Do you remember what those experiments were?
I'm going to have to poke around for a while to see that.
Yeah, they might be in my notes.
I took a ton of notes on this paper because he covers so much fascinating territory.
And then you're out of it. Oh, well. That's the problem with notes. If you take too many notes,
they're not useful anymore. Oh, I think it was some kind of scattering experiment. Ion scattering. Wasn't it some kind of scattering experiment? Yeah, here it is. The corrections in principle can be measured in low-energy kiloelectron-volt scattering experiments. Scattering of positrons against heavy ions. So they've already apparently detected some kind of anomaly, which looks like it might be the thing that he's predicted here. That's brilliant.
And an interesting way to get a gravitational effect in a terrestrial experiment.
Yeah. Let's see, what else did he get into here that was so cool?
I think the interesting thing is that he was also saying, though, that an interesting conversion, the electromagnetic wave to gravitational wave and back to an electromagnetic wave, process is undetectable by lab experiments. Oh, crap. No, that was the previous paper.
Yeah, I think he barely mentioned the Gertzenstein effect in this paper.
Yeah, it just sort of showed up. So, I mean, I was looking for
the Gertzenstein. It's a mouthful.
Yeah. Yeah, I was looking for the Gertzenstein effect, and this one popped up. And I really just sort of looked at the title and looked at the sort of size of the effects. Gravitationally induced electromagnetic effects in microphysics. That's big and the small. That gives us everything. Right. So I thought they would be good together.
Yeah. I love this paper. This is one of the best finds I've ever seen in our podcast research. He gets into such a great fundamental examination of both the electromagnetic and the gravitational properties of stuff like the electron and at the Compton wavelength. And you're just looking and you just feel like you're getting almost like a sneak preview of some kind of breakthrough in quantum gravity. Like this is a scale where, you know, we're actually seeing the things interacting at the atomic scale. It's so fundamental, you know. Oh, yeah. There's a cool statement at the end of his paper where he says, at this scale, at like the approximately the Compton scale or the reduced Compton scale, at this scale, the dominating source of the gravitational field is shifted from the mass to the spin. That's serious spin going on at the atomic scale, you know.
I mean, the idea is that the gravitational field is so weak, right, at that scale, that you rarely see any effect. But because it's spinning, you're getting some additional effects from the angular momentum, and that's giving you a lot of things to work with. Now, the interesting thing about this paper is that he decided that he didn't care so much about the balancing of the forces. He cared about balancing of the fields, right? Mm-hmm.
That's right.
And he was, of course, doing this in some theorist units, geometric units, with C and G equal to 1 and the permittivity of free space at 1 over 4 pi.
Right. You always see that stuff when theorists are getting into that really fundamental regime.
Well, this is why you end up with statements like the gravitational size of the electron, which is its Schwarzschild radius, is much less than the charge of the electron, which is much less than the Compton wavelength for the electron, right? Which is just a really weird thing to have that charge of the electron sandwich in there. You know, it's just always weird to read theorist stuff like that.
Yeah, that whole length thing. At the fundamental theoretical level, there's all these lengths that you can assign to all the different, I guess, what, forces or fields? Counterintuitive, but apparently it helps them find their way through these discussions. Let me see, what else did I find in here that was so cool? Let's see. Oh, yeah, he said there was a paper where they talked about how when you drop an uncharged particle into a black hole, that it generates like the same amount of electromagnetic and gravitational radiation.
With an uncharged particle. And why was it?
I'm not sure why, but it was a finding in a paper that he was talking about. They showed, and this is, he's talking about the Johnston, Ruffini, and Zarelli paper. Said the first paper they showed that a neutral particle following into a Reissner-Nordström black hole generates electromagnetic radiation. And he said they also calculated the flux of electromagnetic radiation and found that it was of the same order of magnitude as the flux of gravitational radiation. I really should have looked up what a Reissner-Nordström black hole is, but it's intriguing that you get the same flux from both forms of radiation. Let's see, he says, this is an example of gravitationally induced electromagnetic effect. In the second paper, they considered the same situation, but with a charged particle, which provides an example of the opposite effect, namely electromagnetically induced gravitational radiation. And he said earlier, Gertzenstein discussed briefly the possibility of resonance between the two types of fields, so...
Gertzenstein did it one way, then I think Lupinov did it the other way, and then other people have been looking at it in different ways ever since. But I don't think they've really seen it.
Yeah, I don't think they've seen it yet either, but it's really cool. That's so true. I mean, so many of these exotic general relativistic effects, it's like theoretically they're really fascinating, but they're just too weak for us to observe in any meaningful sense. He made a statement in here where he said that mass, spin, charge, and magnetic dipole comprise all the four known multipole moments of the electron.
Okay, say that again.
Mass, spin, charge, and magnetic dipole. They comprise all the four known multipole moments of the electron.
I mean, how does the magnetic dipole differ from the spin?
Well, I guess there's a mass angular momentum, and then there's an electrical charge angular momentum, right?
Well, yeah, but the magnetic dipole and the spin are...
They're related, but...
They're the same thing. There's a constant. There's the Bohr magneton, which is basically just a constant that puts them together. So, I mean, they're linearly related. They're the same thing. The electron doesn't have a lot of quantum numbers. It has its mass, its spin, and its charge.
But if it didn't have a charge, it would still have a spin, so...
Yeah, the spin and the charge are unrelated. So I guess possibly what he's trying to say is that you get the orbital plus the spin angular momentum to give you the magnetic dipole, in which case that's a slightly different thing, but that magnetic dipole is no longer a quantum number as far as I understand it. Maybe it is in a particular system.
But I don't understand. Is he saying that mass is a multiple moment?
Well, it is if you're talking about the gravitational stuff, right? If you're talking about the gravitational thing, then the mass is the gravitational monopole moment.
But why would he call it a multipole if it's a monopole?
Well, because it's the first one. But yeah, I mean, it's just the first of what could be many, right? Could be an infinite number to describe the system. So if you have a distribution of mass, then you'd start with what is the total mass to give you the first idea about what the gravitational field is going to be. And then you add in the dipole part, and then you add in the quadrupole part and the octupole part and so forth. And that's going to give you your actual field, right? So if you have a spherically symmetric distribution, you can just use Gauss's law, and that'll give you everything you need to know about the field. But if it's not spherically symmetric, then you have those corrections, and those corrections are the higher order moments.
Even though we think that the electron is like a point-like particle, we're kind of assuming that at some level it's not, and that at least the fields are deformed by these various spins and so forth, right?
Well, we know that the spin, which is basically the magnetic moment of the electron, exists. So we've got gravity, electricity, and magnetism, all three things there, right? And the spin is completely quantum mechanical. It does not have anything to do with that charge. So a neutron has a spin. So but I guess it also has a distribution of charges inside, so it'll have a quadrupole moment. But the neutron has a spin, the neutrino has a spin, but the neutrino has no charge, right? And it has no constituent charges as far as we know, but it still has that spin.
I think that the idea with a neutron is that there's like fractional charges that are somehow all cancel out. I mean, they don't have like any isolated charges, but I think somehow a neutron has charge in a sense, but they all cancel out.
Well, I mean, a neutron does, but a neutrino...
Right. Oh, is that what you're saying, a neutrino? I'm sorry, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the neutron, that was the first thing I was saying, but then I realized the neutrino was a better example, because it definitely has this half-integer spin, but it has no charge. So it's not the charge that's doing that. It's this quantum of angular momentum exists for all fermions at some level. It is distinct from the charge. Now, in an electric field and a magnetic field, they'll both interact with that magnetic field, but they're different things.
I wonder if that's somehow related to the debate about neutrino rest mass. Like, I guess in order to have spin, you've got to have some kind of mass, right?
Since it's going directly to the magnetic moment, I mean, this has not been considered some part of the mass, although possibly for the total energy, it has to be part of that some way, I think.
But he did say at one point here, he said there is a rather widely held belief or view, even in textbooks, that the spin of an elementary particle is a pure quantum phenomenon. He said, however, spin angular momentum is not only quantum mechanical. He made an argument for that when he's talking about the momentum operator commuting with a Dirac Hamiltonian, and said, I think while separately the spin and the orbital angular momentum, they do not commute separately, but together. And he seems to be arguing that there's a component of that angular momentum which is not just a quantum mechanical effect.
Yeah, so he says that means that it's not only quantum mechanical because it has something to do with the orbital angular momentum or the total angular momentum. He's talking about that a little bit in terms of the black holes, and he's saying that the black hole does not have orbital angular momentum. It has spin angular momentum, and it has a G factor of 2 just like any other purely spin thing. Although I'm not sure that's really a great argument for that spin to be non-quantum mechanical. However, this is how he's going to model the electron a little bit, the electron fields, right? Not necessarily the electron, but he's going to model the fields from taking the spin, assuming that it gives you a kind of angular momentum kinetic energy or something like that, and then saying, I can use that to use the Kerr-Newman solution to model my fields at large distances, right? So he's not looking at close distances, he's looking at large distances, and that's going to give this effect that I want to look at.
That's interesting. I hadn't really landed with me until you just explained it that way. He is using the black hole physics as a setup to try to talk about the electron, which is really kind of fascinating because, you know, it's easy to forget that a black hole is a quantum object. One point here, he gives an equation. He says, it is now clear from equation 15 that general relativity predicts that the gravitational field of a spinning charge induces changes in its electromagnetic field, which makes it deviate from a pure Coulomb form at small distances. So he's talking about the gravitomagnetic effects altering like the Coulomb field.
So yeah, that's basically what he's trying to say, is that we get these gravitomagnetic effects, so we get things happening that are different from the Coulomb field, and that's going to give us something interesting.
Yeah, I've never thought of, I mean, I guess, well, black hole theorists probably think about this kind of stuff all the time, but I never thought about, like, frame dragging in a Coulomb field. It must have some odd lines of force going on there, you know?
But even this guy is not going to that level. He's just looking at the large distance issues. But if you do have frame dragging going on near an electron, that's still going to affect it. So it's always hard to think about that with the electron because it's so small. And, I mean, it's so small that, well, I mean, we were just talking about this, that you have this Schwarzschild radius of 10 to the minus 58 meters. So we know that it's much, much smaller than the Planck length. And we can't get anything smaller than like 10 to the minus 22 meters, which is much, much larger than the Planck length. So we have really no idea how big it is. Probably there's some reason why it can't be a little black hole, but it has to be at least that big. You know, I've looked at the few reasons, and I'm not sure that I believe them all, but I mean, there seem to be some good reasons to say that the electron should be larger than that. And then you have something about the dipole moment of the electron. So the electric charge should have a dipole moment as well as, you know, this spin dipole moment that we have, at least according to the standard model, which is, again, why they keep doing these experiments to try to figure out how spherical the electron is, because the standard model says it's not.
But it doesn't give you an idea of how much it's not? Is that the problem?
Yeah, I'm not completely sure exactly what the level is, but the size that they're looking at right now, it doesn't seem to bother them. So that deviation can't be too much.
Yeah, right, because they've gotten some incredibly precise measurements. I guess that's they do scattering with higher and higher energies to try to find a deviation. Is that it?
They really only have one big trick.
Increase the speed of the collision?
Increase the speed of the collision. As far as I know, I mean, if they want, we can interview them and they can tell us all the cool tricks that they want. Yeah, just contact us because we don't have a producer.
That's right.
So, yeah, maybe we should figure out how much it'll cost to get us a producer.
More than we have.
Well, yeah, almost certainly, yeah. Forward this to your favorite experimental high-energy physics researcher, and maybe they'll want to get in touch with us and tell us all the cool things that they're doing and why exactly they think they'll be able to figure out that the electron has a funny football shape.
That sounds great.
And then we have to figure out a name for a new show.
Why? That's on the frontiers of physics, isn't it?
Yeah, but, I mean, this is us talking. We need another one. You know, we need to expand if we're going to do an interview show.
Well, I mean, maybe we can just evolve.
Or we could evolve, yeah. But yeah, this is my Randy time, Randy.
You don't want to share it?
I don't want to share my Randy time.
Oh, that's sweet of you. And you know what? I wanted to do a little shout out at the end of this program. One of our kind listeners, Brendan, had written and offered some great suggestions. And I think we incorporated some of those a couple months ago. And he seems to be pleased with the increase in the audio quality. So you're doing something right.
Well, I didn't see any of those, so I have no idea what I did.
I sent you that months ago, but he seems to be happy with the way it's sounding. And yeah, I just want to thank everybody for listening.
So is that you saying that you've had enough fun? You've thanked Brandon?
Yeah, I think we're ready to go. But, you know, I think this is great, especially that third paper you found. I'm going to have to go over that a couple more times because it just covers a lot of really fascinating ground in a really fascinating way.
Well, he also has several other things where he's talking about similar things, I think a little bit earlier than this paper. So you can also look at his earlier papers as well. His recent papers seem to be more on some sort of discrete cosmology, and I'm not sure what that is, but he has several of them that have to do with these sorts of effects.
Well, let's take a closer look at Dr. Rosquist's work and see what else he's been up to, because I like the way he thinks.
All right. Well, then, thank you very much, Randy.
Thank you, James.
And I will talk to you next time.
All right. Until next time on Physics Frontiers.
Okay, great.
Bye, Jim.
Bye now. You have just listened to Physics Frontiers, Episode 48, The Gerstenstein Effect. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/48. Show notes include the papers that we talked about, as well as related episodes and similar things. Thank you very much. Good night.